culture. And I really wanted people to understand that as I went through the process of being approved for Death with Dignity, that I felt very valued by my physicians here and very protected. There's no way I could have possibly been coerced into this. It's not a fear-based choice, it's a logic-based choice. And coming to realize how much our culture fears death and shuns death, and how much of the medical community almost, as on a patient side, like it feels as though they view death as a failure, which I understand, except for not when you're dealing with terminally ill patients, because by definition they are dying. If I can play even the smallest part in helping to reduce fear or misunderstanding, then it's worth speaking up for.
The video was released one day after the late Brittany Maynard was criticized by the Vatican, who called her choice reprehensible. More than 700 people have used Oregon's Right to Die law as of the beginning of this year. Only 6 of these people were younger than age 35, including 29-year-old Brittany Maynard. Today would have been her 30th birthday.
Last night on the KBOO News, we reported about the fumes that are making workers sick at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington. These fumes are extremely toxic, and the administration at Hanford delayed informing the workers and the public about the danger. Now the Attorney General of Washington has issued a public statement saying that the state will take legal action against Hanford to address the toxic fumes. For more, KBOO's Chris Andre spoke with well-known Hanford whistleblower and former contractor Walter Tomositis.
The vapor issue has existed for years, and the contractors have resisted or not done anything. The vapors appear to be sudden releases, and the people have been complaining for years, and they're and being sickened for years. And they have done past surveys and said you had to, wear respirators, protect your employees, but the contractors did nothing. Most recently, the Savannah River National Laboratory was brought in and confirmed that, yes, indeed, there are releases, and you have to take action. And now the state of Washington has threatened to sue DOE and the contractor, URS, if they don't take action. So just like the ruling in the Ninth District Circuit Court against URS in my case, and also the Shelley Doss case where the Department of Labor ruled for Shelley Doss, the things which the contractors are doing and how they treat people and how they disregard safety and how they retaliate are all beginning to surface, and they're being, coming to light. So hopefully, as we go forward, action will be taken so that they'll correct their ways and not retaliate against people, protect people, and protect the environment.
How might they, in this case, retaliate? It seems that, I suppose, by firing people, what are the chances of retaliation that the people may face?
Well, I think clearly they could retaliate against the people by saying they're faking it, attempting to say that the employees are lying. On the other hand, the state of Washington, the federal government could sue the contractor and make URS pay a heavy fine for their actions. And if they did that, a heavy fine would certainly send a signal to all other contractors within the DOE business not to fool around, that if there's a problem, they got to address it. The issue that's also at hand, though, is in many of the legal cases, the contractors get paid back from DOE, from the government. Even in my case, they've been paid millions to defend their self against me. So taxpayers are, in essence, paying the companies through DOE to fight me, and that's got to be changed. And Senator McCaskill from Missouri has a major effort underway with that, and I hope with the new Congress coming in that effort will continue, because Senator McCaskill's done a heck of a job on surfacing that reimbursement. So, some heavy fines can really change your way of doing business.
So the state sues Hanford, no matter what the outcome, this sets a precedent. There are sites where nuclear leaks exist all across the country, not the same scale as Hanford, but I'm sure there's more.
And in the DOE business, the contractors they may be here at Hanford today, and then next year they're not here, and they're at Oak Ridge, or they're at Savannah River. So they move around, and by finding one and registering presence, if you will, showing that they did wrong, that when they move around to another site, they'll be hesitant to want to, to take a sleazy approach to their actions.
What is your current status with regard to legal issues and your work at Hanford and your role as a whistleblower there?
Well, in the two main cases, the Federal District 9 Circuit Court, Appeal Court, made a judgment and ruled for me against URS and said that not only is there enough indication that URS was wrong, that I'm also entitled to a jury trial. So it sets a precedent for the first time to have a jury trial by a group of your peers in a whistleblower case. And the reason I got into all this in the beginning was really to see that the laws are changed to protect the future generations of employees. I don't want to see anything happen to the younger people that I went through. So the Ninth Circuit decision certainly says URS, we're really going to take a good look at what you did, and besides people like Walter entitled to a jury trial, which is a great step forward. We're hoping that in the Bechtel case in the state of Washington, in the Supreme Court in Washington, that they'll also rule that the laws should be examined in how Bechtel was involved in this. I'm really into it to change the law. I want to make it better for people in the future.
That was Hanford whistleblower and former contractor Walter Tomasitis speaking this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia.
Every day this week on the KBOO Evening News, we are presenting a segment of a series created by KBOO reporter Suzanne Legrand about Portland's latest branding as a startup city for tech companies. Here's part two of the new tech boom in Portland on diversity in the tech industry.
At this year's TechFest Northwest, held this past August at OMSI, many attendees, as well as speakers, spoke enthusiastically about the future of technology. By creating a climate that encourages entrepreneurs and small startups, Portland is developing a culture of innovation. One attendee at this year's conference spoke, for example, about, quote, disruptive technologies. I asked her what that meant.
To me, it's just really kind of about flipping something on its head or reframing it and challenging us to look at something differently.
Do you see disruptive technologies as part of a movement for social change?
Definitely, yeah. I think that is where there's great potential, and there are a lot of companies doing that, really looking at the social impact, social impact ventures and challenging people to think about how their technologies can be a positive impact for the world.
The idea that technology can have a positive social impact is one that was widely shared by speakers and attendees alike at this year's TechFest Northwest. I spoke with Patrick Curtin, community manager of Idealist and one of the companies attending this year's TechFest Northwest Talent Fair, about how they are using technology to create social change.
Imagine that you're in a neighborhood and you have an eyesore lot that everybody hates. If you had a way to come and say, at this location, at this spot, I see this and I wish it was different, that would be one thing. If other people said the same thing, then that would be a chance to kind of group around that problem and that need. Then if there were people in that same locale who said, hey, I'm into gardening, I'm into cleaning things up, if anybody needs that, I'm ready to do it. Think of an OkCupid that's not between people trying to date, but between needs and people willing to meet needs.
For 11-year-old entrepreneur Amin Hussein,
finding an unmet need is the key to creating a new web app.
School districts are kind of broke right now. There's no market in that. So we picked a certain area in the tutor industry where no one was touching, and that's where we started.
In July, he and his team pitched and won the overall prize at Startup Week for Tutor Sherpa, a web application that assists parents of special needs children in finding qualified tutors. For Amin, helping solve a problem makes good business sense.
A lot of presentations, they're talking about the perfect product that is a product that serves people. It's not a product that just supposed to make money without helping anyone. Because if you're helping someone, then they're more willing to pay more.
A lot of the speakers at TechFest Northwest spoke optimistically, among other things, about how technology is changing the nature of storytelling. Matt Mansfield, former digital editor for National Geographic, now a professor at Northwestern University, gave an example of new storytelling from an article he read in Fusion magazine.
They did a story about debt and debt collection. And the way that they told the story was that you could take the role of a debt collector, or you could take the role of the person who's in debt, and you go through the process of debt collection. And then it helps you understand and explain all of the legal aspects of it as well. It's almost like a choose your own adventure to go through it. And I think, like, as we're thinking about storytelling and we're thinking about, you know, what the medium can do, how we can interact with it, I think we have these opportunities to do something completely different and new that's exciting.
Another speaker at this year's TechFest Northwest was Justin Farrell, director of the Institute of Design at Stanford University. Product design, he argued, should focus not on selling, but on solving a problem for the user.
You know, a lot of times in projects, companies will say, we're going to make this thing, and then they go and figure out how to do it, and then they figure out how to sell it. Human-centered design is really about, you know, how you understand the needs of the people that you're creating something for, whether it's a product or a service. If you know who your user is, and that user has a name and has a need, and your team has talked to that person, that when you're arguing about your differences, you're always tying it back to them. It's not about you, it's about them. The entire purpose is to create something for someone else that makes their life better.
Solving a problem, making life better, having a positive impact for the world. For many developers, designers, and entrepreneurs attending TechFest Northwest, new technology, in addition to creating new businesses, is also transforming how business is being done. Here's Mara Zapata, co-founder of Switchboard.
On the one hand, we have this model of small, bootstrapped companies. So on the other hand, you have Facebook. And in the middle, there has to be something in the middle. There has to be a place where you can create a sustainable, profitable, thriving business that takes into consideration both your users and your investors. And I think what we're starting to see is some really exciting and interesting investors that are coming along, the types of funds that are investing in things like Kickstarter or Meetup. And they're saying, look, community really matters. We want you to build a sustainable community that can make us money and let your community thrive.
In the final part of this series on new technology in Portland, I'll take a look at future trends in technology and some of the problems created by the recent tech boom in Portland. Among them, housing, rising rents, and concerns about who will be able to afford to live in Portland in the future. This is Suzanne LeGrand reporting for KBOO Community Radio.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth feature on a Volunteers of America facility in Southeast Portland that helps women rise out of addiction into a better life, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be wet and cold, with a high of 50, a low of 45, and a 100% chance of rain. Today in history, the Nuremberg trials against 24 leading Nazi officials began in 1945, and in 1969, Native American activists took control of Alcatraz Island and would hold it for 19 months. The quote of the day is from Leo Tolstoy's writings on civil disobedience and nonviolence. I sit on a man's back, choking him, making him carry me, and yet assure myself and others that I feel very sorry for him and wish to ease his lot by any means possible, except getting off his back.
The situation remains tense in Ferguson, Missouri, as people await the verdict of the grand jury on whether charges will be filed against the officer who killed unarmed black teenager Michael Brown in August. In anticipation of what he termed civil unrest, the governor of Missouri has declared a state of emergency and called upon the National Guard to prepare them to be deployed on the streets of Missouri. In response, community organizers and clergy in Ferguson and nearby areas held a press teleconference to share their message that the black youth in these areas are the victims of a system of oppression, and the media and government should stop blaming the victims. Here's a sample of the voices represented.
My name is Reverend Tracy Blackman. I serve as pastor of Christ the King United Church of Christ in Florissant, Missouri, which is a neighboring municipality to Ferguson, and as of yesterday became one of the 16 commissioners on the newly established Ferguson Commission. My call to this particular work at this particular time is rooted in the fact that I have members of my congregation who live in Canfield, and some still do, some have moved since the killing of Michael Brown, who called upon me on the day that he was killed to get involved. And as a mother of two African-American black males who are in the same age range as Michael Brown, and also as a child of the 60s from Birmingham, Alabama, I am accustomed to the disparities that exist between law enforcement and our black community. And to see that baby laying in the street like that for 4.5 hours drew me into this fight. And the movement of the young people that are leading this charge at this time energized me and keep me committed to this fight beyond just justice for Michael Brown, but justice for all of our children.
I'm Tori Russell, co-founder of Hands Up United. It all started for me on August 9th. From that day on, I've been doing work in Ferguson and all over the St. Louis area. For me, I'm an education advocate. I know that what I've been doing in the community in Canfield, North Winds, and North and West St. Louis City has been political education and informing people around the Mike Brown death, Von Derrick Myers, Kajim Powell, Kimberly Randall King, and even Christopher Jones prior to Mike Brown. So there's a lot of things going on, and I think that a lot of the youth have come out with us to be a part of the solution process. We look at systemic issues around education, around mass incarceration, around deportation, and things that are really issues that are preventing us from getting the justice as well as being killed in the streets. So we've worked on, we also sit on the Don't Shoot Coalition. So we have, put 19 rules of engagement, part of OBS, partner with OBS for the police reform regionally as well as nationally, education reform around, curriculum or, just proper, classroom conditions or building conditions or, homelessness. So it's a lot of issues that we're branching out. And I see Hands Up as a local thing that's quickly spreading national and even international. We have some allies in the Congo and Brazil, Chile, Venezuela, Paris and London, who are also joining up and who wants to be a part of the Hands Up movement.
I'm Tef Poe. Most people just refer to me as Poe or Tef. I believe my position that I play in Ferguson is a more of a, I take a cultural stance. I try to use the art and my past as an organizer and some of the things I've learned in grassroots organizing to kind of bring the struggle into the modern era of civil rights and human rights and just rights for people that are oppressed, period, you know. In St. Louis, we have a really deeply rooted institutionalized racism, institutionalized segregation. And you really can't understand it if you haven't put boots on the ground and felt it for yourself. We can sit here and talk till we're blue in the face, but it's a really deeply rooted, sadistic, evil type of racism. It's not the normal call you the N-word behind your back racism. So with all our powers combined, we come together and try to really take an aggressive stance against this activity. And I believe that's what got us to this point right now.
Those were the voices of community organizers in the area around Ferguson, Missouri, who are challenging the mainstream media narrative, which they say is prejudiced against youth of color in Ferguson. The full recording will be posted on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. Look under the audio tab for Ferguson Youth Speak Out.
A 37-year-old Cleveland woman who was suffering a mental health crisis was killed by police who slammed her head into the pavement while her family watched in horror. The incident took place 1 week ago today, but some of the details are just being made public. Tanisha Anderson was suffering from a mental health crisis, and police received a call that she was, quote, disturbing the peace. They decided to, quote, take her down, but in doing so, they bashed her head against the concrete, killing her. Tanisha's brother said the police used unnecessary force and refused family offers to talk Tanisha down. To add insult to injury, he said, Tanisha's sundress had lifted above her waist, and police refused to pull it down as she lay unconscious in the street. The Cleveland Police Department said their Division of Police Use of Deadly Force Investigation Team is, quote, investigating the case. No officers involved have been fired, reprimanded, or placed on leave.
An international private equity firm is trying to acquire 100% of the common stock of the Australian coal and shale company that's trying to develop two Northwest coal export projects. Several nationally recognized coal industry experts gathered for a media conference in Seattle where they analyzed this change of ownership in the company Amber Energy and explained how the coal industry is becoming a high-risk investment. Clark Williams-Derry, the Research and Communications Director for Sightline Institute, shares his thoughts on the shifting coal industry.
Getting back to Amber, Amber is essentially a startup company. It has no assets to speak of in Australia. But we just found out really just last night that Amber has filed documents with the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, which is their version of the SEC, in which they're proposing to sell all of their North American assets to their main investor. That investor is a firm called Resource Capital Funds. They're a private equity firm with offices in the U.S. and Canada and Australia. And they specialize, RCF specializes in mining startups and highly speculative mining investments. So really what we're seeing is it's a rotating cast of characters. It's almost like flip that port where we see speculative investors coming in, bailing out other speculative investors. Through the rotating cast of characters stepping on and off the stage in the Northwest Port Arena. And for communities and governments trying to figure out who exactly it is that they're dealing with, this creates a very difficult challenge.
That was Clark Williams-Derry, the Research and Communications Director for Sightline Institute. He's been discussing the change in ownership of coal ports. Now we move to Tom Sanzillo, the Director of Finance for the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
We think that partnership needs to be made carefully, and our recommendation would be that if they want growth in the state, they need to find another partner to continue the quality of growth and the type and the level of growth that they've had in the past.
That was Tom Senzillo, an expert on coal industry economics. Senzillo was part of a media briefing in Seattle where industry specialists discussed the implications for the proposed Northwest coal export terminals.
Just hours before, a Palestinian bus driver was lynched by unknown assailants on Sunday. A well-known right-wing Israeli posted a picture of himself on Facebook holding a noose with the caption, "Death to Arabs." The bus driver was lynched in the bus he was driving in an Israeli settlement and left hanging for hours from a bar inside the bus. When police finally removed the driver's bruised and beaten body from the makeshift noose, they immediately declared the death a suicide. This led to increased protests in the streets of Jerusalem, which Israeli police have met with excessive force. No charges have been filed against the Israeli settler leader, who published the photos of himself holding the noose.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org. Palestinian human rights groups have reported that a detained Palestinian child from Jerusalem was seriously injured during interrogation at an Israeli interrogation center in Salah al-Din Street in occupied East Jerusalem. Khadr al-Ajlouni, 16 years of age, was pushed down at a flight of stairs at the police station and suffered serious injuries to his neck, arm, and back, according to local sources. It added that the child was transferred to a hospital in the city after becoming unable to move one of his arms and one of his legs. On Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers detonated the home of Abdulrahman Shaloudi in Silwan town, south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem. Israel claims Shaloudi, who was shot dead on October 23rd, deliberately rammed his car into Israelis waiting for the light rail. An Israeli infant was killed in the incident and seven other Israelis were wounded. While many reports indicate he might have lost control of his vehicle due to high speed and illness. In other news, Palestinian medical sources have reported that dozens of children have been injured during clashes with Israeli soldiers near the Shafat refugee camp and Anata town northwest of occupied East Jerusalem on Wednesday. In Gaza, Israeli media reported gunshots fired near Eretz crossing between Israel and the northern Gaza Strip on Wednesday. According to the report, gunshots were fired towards Israeli forces at the crossing without causing any injuries. From its part, Israeli artillery fired about 30 smoke missiles on farms and fields of Gazan citizens near Beit Hanun City. No injuries were reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 19th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Manoura.
A group of Portlanders gathered yesterday afternoon outside a federal building to show solidarity with Chicago-based Palestinian-American activists who have been imprisoned by immigration authorities. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Sarah Swetsoff, one of the organizers of the Portland event.
Sarah, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about who Rasmia Odeh is?
Rasmia Odeh is an older Palestinian organizer from the Chicago area. She's been living in the U.S. for decades. She is well known for running classes, helping Arab women in Chicago become better established and kind of navigate the healthcare system and the education system and find employment and get education. So she was truly a beloved member of the community.
I understand that she has been charged with immigration fraud. What are the charges against her by the U.S. government?
So Rasmia was naturalized about 10 years ago, and she's accused of falsifying information on her naturalization form. And the question of concern was regarding past incarceration or conviction, and she was filling out the forms, and she thought the, you know, 2 decades she'd already been in the U.S., you know, okay, no, I've never gotten in trouble for anything, check no. And 10 years go by, and now all of a sudden, you know, Homeland Security in October last year is knocking at her door, saying you're under arrest for falsifying, you know, purposefully falsifying information on your naturalization form. So it's all, it's very disturbing. She did have a record. She had a record in Israel before she came to the United States. She was actually, you know, falsely connected with an act of violence there, and she was held in jail, and she was tortured, she was sexually abused in jail. I won't go into all the details because I know it could be a trigger for some people, but it's really quite extreme, the kinds of torture that she went through in jail. And she was tortured into a false confession, and she was then later released in a prisoner swap not very long after that, which just goes to show sort of the complete absurdity of these types of trial convictions, that someone who would be convicted for doing something quite violent would then be, you know, sort of let out a year later on a prisoner swap. It's completely, you know, politically motivated to silence voices of dissent. And she left that behind her, and she came to live in the United States, but now she's being silenced in a similar way, you know, having the federal government go after her, basically in a witch hunt, targeting her because of her effectiveness as an organizer and a community leader, and trying to decommission her leadership by putting her behind bars on kind of trumped up and totally ludicrous charges.
Do you see any similarities between this case and that of Francisco Aguirre, who was recently in a church for over a month for sanctuary here in the Portland area when he was targeted by immigration officials? He's a well-known community organizer and activist in Portland.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think there's a strong parallel between Francisco's case. Like, obviously he's not as well known on a national level, but for Portland, you know, he is our Resnia Oda, that he was speaking out, he was organizing with his community for undocumented people here in Portland, and, you know, they sort of found some excuse to come after him based on some aspect of his papers or his documents, and try to deport him. There are many similarities. Resnia Oda, when she sentenced in March, she could be sentenced with deportation. So what does that mean? You know, she goes back to Palestine, occupied by an Israeli apartheid state that tortured her and imprisoned her, you know, decades ago. Certainly very many parallels between the two cases.
Again, I've been speaking with Sarah Swetsoff. She's with Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A few minutes ago, President Obama made an announcement on immigration reform. He said that people who have been in the country for over 5 years, who have children and no criminal record, can register for a protected status in the U.S. He addressed his critics' claim that this deal is amnesty for undocumented immigrants, saying that amnesty is actually what we have now, with people living in the shadows. Obama added that every Republican and Democrat president for the last half century has taken executive action on immigration and urged Congress to pass legislation and stop the gridlock.
Are we a nation that tolerates the hypocrisy of a system where workers who pick our fruit and make our beds never have a chance to get right with the law? Or are we a nation that gives them a chance to make amends, take responsibility, and give their kids a better future? Are we a nation that accepts the cruelty of ripping children from their parents' arms? Or are we a nation that values families and works together to keep them together? Are we a nation that educates the world's best and brightest in our universities, only to send them home to create businesses in countries that compete against us? Or are we a nation that encourages them to stay and create jobs here, create businesses here, create industries right here in America? That's what this debate is all about. We need more than politics as usual when it comes to immigration. We need reasoned, thoughtful, compassionate debate that focuses on our hopes, not our fears.
The president's plan, while welcomed by immigrants' rights advocates, will still leave many local undocumented people unprotected. KBOO News reporter Eric Tegedoff spoke with Romeo Sosa, executive director of the VOS Workers' Rights Education Project, about Obama's history on immigration and who will be left behind under these new reforms.
What has the Obama administration done in the past for immigration reform, if anything?
For the Latino community, he hasn't done anything really, and basically what he has done is deport more than 2 million people, and a lot of that in any other administration they have done in the past. So we hope that this is the time for him to really show his power, that he can do the executive action tonight, and really because they don't agree with it to the House of Representatives, with the Senate. So there's like a back and forth, and there's no solution. While there's that debate, a lot of people, they get separated from their families, and they got deported. And every day, we have 1,100 people, it's been deported. So when we ask at this time to stop the deportation while the immigration debate is still going on, and we don't know what does that mean, like for the announcement, executive order today, but we would like to stop the deportation. Not one more family gets separated, not one more our community be deported. And the other thing that worries me is the militarization on the border and internal control that use the technology or different sources to detect and arrest and deported people. The militarization in the border, I always don't understand, because it's been always secured the border. There's too many border patrol, ICE agents, and even the soldiers that are in that area. It's like a war zone. So what else?